Republic of Iran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign minister says the U.S. must comply with its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal before asking Tehran to do so. U.S. House prosecutors wrap up their impeachment case against former President Donald Trump, urging the Senate to convict him of inciting the January attack on the Capitol. Also ahead, Chinese authorities banned BBC World News from airing in China, accusing it of giving fake and biased reports. It's good to have you with us. So Iran's foreign minister has called on the U.S. to comply with its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal before asking Iran to do so. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said Washington withdrew from the international accord in 2018 and punished the countries that were complying with the United Nations resolution that endorsed the deal. He added that President Joe Biden's administration is still in the same position, but keeps talking about Iran's compliance with the nuclear agreement. His comments come amid a standoff between Tehran and Washington, with each asking the other to act first to salvage the joint comprehensive plan of action. Political commentator Ian Michael Jones says the goal of the United States has always been to destroy Iran, whether Democrats or Republicans were in power.
The goal has always been to destroy Iran, one way or the other. And I think the Democrats had an idea that if over the long haul we could simply subvert the entire country with things like the color revolution of 2009, the failed color revolution of 2009. If they could gain time and they could gain access, I think they felt that they could bring about the fall of the revolutionary government. Now, what has happened here is we have 4 years now of a man who came to power, Donald Trump, by telling us he was going to withdraw from the Middle East, never really accomplished that. And in a contradiction to that policy, which was the America First policy, he tightened the screws on Iran and overturned the JCPOA. So the question is, what has happened in this 4 years? What has happened to the Democrats? And it seems to me it should be obvious that when Biden got in, he should overthrow all of Trump's policies. But apparently there's hesitation now. So whether the Democrats have now gone over to the hard line, the Likudnik hard line, is something that we have to anticipate here. Maybe this is the change that's taken place over these 4 years.
Donald Trump's impeachment prosecutors say the former U.S. president should not be allowed to ever hold the top office again.
Dear colleagues, is there any political leader in this room who believes that if he is ever allowed by the Senate to get back into the Oval Office, Donald Trump would stop inciting violence to get his way? Would you bet the lives of more police officers on that? Would you bet the safety of your family on that? Would you bet the future of your democracy on that? President Trump declared his conduct totally appropriate. So, if he gets back into office and it happens again, we'll have no one to blame but ourselves.
The Democratic representative was addressing the Senate during the third day of the impeachment trial for inciting the deadly attack on the Capitol building. Raskin said the assault did not spring into life out of thin air and was in line with the former president's continuing pattern and practice of inciting violence. Representative Ted Lieu also argued that the former president's lack of remorse since the riot shows he intended the events of January the 6th to happen and that such violence could occur again in the future. Earlier, President Joe Biden said the harrowing video evidence of the assault may change some minds.
I think the Senate has a very important job to complete, and I think my guess is some minds may have been changed, but I don't know.
Biden was referring to the videos that were presented by the House impeachment managers during the second day of the trial. The footage shed new light on the extent of the attacks as it showed how a mob left a pro-Trump rally and invaded the Capitol building. Trump supporters were seeking to stop the certification of Biden's November 3rd election victory. The mayhem left five people, including a police officer, dead. The Democratic impeachment managers wrapped up their case. A conviction requires a two-thirds majority in the Senate. If convicted, the Senate could hold a second vote to disqualify the one-term president from seeking office again. White Reed says the Democrats' likely failure to convict Trump has given rise to speculation that the impeachment trial is mere political posturing.
Tomorrow, starting at noon Eastern time, will be the turn of the lawyers for the Trump defense to take their swing at it. They will have up to 16 hours to present their side of the story, although whether they even want to use that the entirety of that time remains to be seen. Their presentation of this impeachment trial is that it's kind of a waste of time, so, you know, it may work out for their logic to sort of, not even use the sheer amount of time that they have. I think their argument is going to be pretty simple. Donald Trump is no longer president. The argument that we heard from Democrats today, specifically from Jonah Goose, Democratic representative from Colorado, they're focused on three main points. Was violence foreseeable? Did Trump encourage violence? And did Trump act willfully? They say the answer to all three of those questions is yes. They still seem to be 11 senators short of that two-thirds majority, which they would need to convict Donald Trump. Again, leading a lot of observers to speculate that this is kabuki theater.
Elsewhere, protesters in Myanmar have held new rallies against the recent coup by the army and its detention of the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The rallies have already begun in Yangon and a southern port city. Friday marks the seventh straight day of anti-coup protests in Myanmar. They have continued despite the military's warning that it would take action against the protesters. Police have already used tear gas, water cannon, and rubber bullets to break up crowds on some occasions. Meanwhile, some government employees, including teachers, have walked off their jobs to protest the coup. The military had claimed voter fraud in November's elections that Suu Kyi's party won by a landslide. The putsch has drawn international condemnation, and the US has imposed sanctions on the coup leaders. China has banned the broadcast of BBC World News, accusing it of giving fake and biased reports. A government statement said the BBC's China-related report seriously violated broadcast guidelines and had harmed China's national interests. That comes a week after a British regulator banned the Chinese broadcaster CGTN over license problems. The ban has provoked the UK's condemnation, with the country's Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab calling the move an unacceptable curtailing of media freedom. Beijing and London are at odds over several issues, including Britain's ban on Chinese telecom group Huawei and the situation in Hong Kong. Fabrizio Goldoni is an analyst and a commentator and joins us now. Fabrizio, welcome. The UK has accused China of an unacceptable curtailing of media freedom. Now, many would be surprised at that statement, saying, you know, the UK knows a thing or two about curtailing and censorship of the media.
Yes, yes. But basically, this kind of, this kind of friction that we had has been started definitely from the UK media regulator, that has pulled the license of China Global Television Network with a very, a little bit ridiculous, pretext. The pretext was the license is wrong because it was issued to China Star Media Limited. So apparently they don't have editorial responsibility and they do not have control over the license service. That is a very debatable point. But the main reason, because China, in my opinion, China Global Television Network was doing a very good job in terms of broadcasting in English, and the audience was interested to the content. Now we do have basically just released the ban for the BBC World News to from hiring anything from China, and what the authorities said that the BBC seriously violated China media regulation after they several reports, actually, but in particular at the early of February with detailing allegation of a torture against Uyghurs in Xinjiang. Now, I mean, personally, I followed quite a long time the issue of Xinjiang, and I have been there personally. I traveled there, extensively, and I do not agree with the BBC position and the way of reporting. The same as I do not agree when BBC was reporting the facts of Hong Kong, where I live.
Tensions are already high over a host of issues. You mentioned the Xinjiang and the Uyghurs.
Yes.
Do you see this as the beginning of another problem between the two countries?
Okay, let's put it this way. There are several area of friction. One you mentioned, that is Xinjiang. Then we have the South China Sea, and we have a Taiwan issue. And we have Hong Kong, and now, luckily, after the national law has become much more quiet and has been, in my opinion, solved. But especially on Xinjiang, I think that they will go on. But I would like to add one more thing, that was also the COVID, because many Western papers, including BBC, take some position about the COVID, not very clear, not very with a journalistic approach that it can be discussed. Yeah.
Right. Thank you very much, Fabrizio, for your insight there. Fabrizio Goldoni, analyst and commentator, joining us out of Hong Kong. Now, moving on, the South Korean government has announced that it will begin COVID-19 vaccinations for its people later this month. This comes as the country is struggling with a growing number of daily in coronavirus infections. Frank Smith has the details.
South Korea Thursday announced the most daily new COVID-19 cases in 2 weeks, as more than 500 people were found to have contracted the virus. South Korea now has about 80,000 cases and 1,500 deaths from COVID-19. The government plans to begin vaccinations for its 52 million people later this month.
The government plans to operate 250 vaccination centers. When all of 250 centers open, we run 250 modules. Then 150,000 people can get vaccinated per day. This means that 4.5 million people can get vaccinated each month.
Meanwhile, Thursday, many South Koreans traveled back to their hometowns for the Lunar New Year holiday.
South Korea has tried to strike a balance between containing the spread of the virus and social and economic sacrifice. Cafes and restaurants have pretty much stayed open while restricting hours and seating capacity. And wearing a mask in public or while taking mass transportation is quite strictly enforced.
Most public places have temperature-checking sensors. For private businesses, people are required to sign in on paper or digitally. Still, most were glad to travel, albeit carefully.
Last year, I couldn't go to my hometown for the Lunar New Year or Thanksgiving. I was sad I couldn't meet my family or parents very often, so I'm finally going this year.
The vaccine will be welcome, as many businesses have closed and unemployment spiked.
The fact that it will take some time for everyone to get the vaccine and for the COVID-19 situation to die down is a bit difficult to deal with and unfortunate. But I was very happy to hear that we will be able to get vaccinated this year.
Although people generally follow the rules, new variants have been discovered in the country, and health officials warn levels may again increase, prompting stricter measures. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Now, the European Parliament has called for a European Union-wide ban on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and its allies who are attacking Yemen. In a joint motion, the bloc's member states were urged to place an embargo on the export, sale, update and maintenance of any form of security equipment to the Saudi-led coalition. The motion cited serious breaches of international humanitarian and human rights law committed by the coalition in Yemen. The European Parliament also called for EU sanctions against the human rights violators in the Arab country. The motion welcomed the Germany's arms sale ban to Saudi Arabia and Italy's ban to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. Now, Israel is reportedly planning to build new settlement units in the occupied West Bank. An Israeli newspaper said the new units will be built in occupied central Jerusalem al-Quds. According to the report, the plan includes the construction of several 24-story buildings, 250 protected units, and hundreds of offices and other facilities. Earlier this week, reports said Israeli authorities were planning to expand the settlements in Jerusalem al-Quds by 900 new units. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. The French Justice Minister has asked all prosecutors in France to condemn the BDS movement that calls for boycott, divestment and sanctions against Israel. But the European Court for Human Rights said last year that this boycott movement is legal. So who is right, who is wrong? Our correspondent in Paris has more.
Actions calling for the boycott of Israeli products will not be possible anymore if the French Minister of Justice, Dupont Moretti, succeeds in his intentions. In a letter, he instructed all prosecutors, magistrates and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products because it is a discrimination against the nation, he says. But an important group of French people reacted publicly, stating that BDS is legitimate and legal. In June last year, the European Court for Human Rights said that boycott is a legal political weapon. Pierre Stamboul is member of the board of the French Jewish Union for Peace and a BDS activist. His father was deported by the Nazis.
In France and in the USA, many Jews are involved in the BDS movement because Israel and the Zionist movement commit crimes against the Palestinians. The Israeli policy is an insult to our memory, our history, and our identity. Today, we see that France is again complicit with Israel. But nevertheless, France has been condemned by the European Court of Human Rights to pay 100,000 euros to BDS activists who organized the boycott action.
For lawyer Dominique Cochin, the judgment of the European Court prevails over the French directives.
That means that France is committed to respect the judgments of the European Court of Human Rights. Minister Moretti pretends to obey this judgment. It says in Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights that the boycott is a totally legitimate political way of expression. But the French Minister of Justice, with this letter, tries again to criminalize the appeal to boycott.
The appeal to BDS has been launched by the Palestinians in 2005 and had a support all over the world, with remarkable events also in France, with actions in supermarkets or boat protests against the inauguration of a Ben-Gurion square. They ask the end of the colonization and occupation of Palestine. The French Minister of Justice would like BDS activists to appear in courthouses like this to be condemned for criticizing Israel. That will not be easy because most lawsuits against BDS are won by the activists till now. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
That report brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely, thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The limelight.
The pandemic has led to a dramatic increase in the number of American people who say their mental health has suffered, rising from 1 in 3 people in March to more than half of people polled by KFF in July. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Matt Wohl's editor. This article is published under the heading, U.S. states are poised to cut mental health care despite rising demand under COVID. Stay tuned for the details, please. States across the U.S. are still being hurt after businesses closed and millions of people lost jobs due to COVID-related shutdowns and restrictions. Meanwhile, the pandemic has led to a dramatic increase in the number of people who say their mental health has suffered, rising from 1 in 3 people in March to more than half of people polled by KFF in July. The full extent of the mental health crisis and the demand for behavioral health services may not be known until after the pandemic is over, mental health experts said. That could add costs that budget writers haven't anticipated. It usually takes a while before people feel comfortable seeking care from a specialty behavioral health organization, said Chuck Ingoglia, president and CEO of the nonprofit National Council for Behavioral Health in Washington, D.C. We're not likely to see the results of that either in terms of people seeking care or suicide rates going up until we are on the other side of the pandemic. Last year, states slashed agency budgets, froze pay, furloughed workers, borrowed money, and tapped into rainy day funds to make ends meet. Health programs, often among the most expensive part of a state's budget, were targeted for cuts in several states across the U.S., even as health officials led efforts to stem the spread of the coronavirus. This year, the outlook doesn't seem quite so bleak due in part to relief packages passed by Congress last spring and in December that buoyed state economies. Another major advantage was that income increase or held steady for people with well-paying jobs and investment income, which boosted the state's tax revenues even as millions of lower-income workers were laid off. It has turned out to be not as bad as it might have been in terms of state budgets, said Mike Lichtman, Vice President for State Fiscal Policy for the Nonpartisan Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. But many states across the U.S. still face cash shortfalls that will be made worse if additional federal aid doesn't come, Lichtman said. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat, predicted his state would have a plug, a $15 billion deficit with spending cuts and tax increases if a fresh round of aid doesn't materialize. Some states, such as New Jersey, borrowed to make their budgets whole, and they're going to have to start paying that money back. Tourism states, such as Hawaii, and energy-producing states, such as Alaska, Wyoming, continue to face grim economic outlooks with oil, gas, and coal prices down and tourists cutting back on travel, Lichtman said. Even states with a relatively rosy economic outlook are being cautious. In Colorado, for example, Democratic Governor Jared Polis proposed a budget that restores the cuts made last year to Medicaid and substance abuse programs. But health providers are doubtful the legislature will approve any significant spending increases in this economy. Everybody right now is just trying to protect and make sure we don't have additional cuts, said Doyle Forrestal, CEO of the Colorado Behavioral Healthcare Council. Montana is one of the few states with a budget on a two-year cycle, so this is the first time lawmakers have had to craft spending plans since the pandemic began. Revenue forecasts predict healthy tax collections over the next 2 years. In January, at the start of the legislative session, the panel in charge of building the state health department's budget proposed starting with nearly $1 billion in cuts. The panel's chairperson, Republican Representative Matt Ridger, pledged to add back programs and services on their merits during the month-long budget process. Republicans, who are in control of the Montana House, Senate, and Governor's Office for the first time in 16 years, are considering reducing the income tax level for the state's top earners, such a measure that could affect state revenue in an uncertain economy, has some observers concerned, particularly when an increased need for health services is expected. Mary Wind Decker, Executive Director of the Behavioral Health Alliance of Montana, said that health providers across the state are still clawing back from more than $100 million in budget cuts in 2017, and that she worries more cuts are on the horizon. But one bright spot, she said, is a proposal by new governor Greg Gianforte, a Republican, to create a fund that would put $23 million a year toward community substance abuse prevention and treatment programs. It would be partially funded by tax revenue the state will receive from recreational parts, which voters approved in November, with sales to begin next year. Windecker cautioned, though, that mental health and substance use are linked, and the governor and lawmakers should plan with that in mind. In public's mind, there is drug addicts, and there are mentally ill people, she said. Quite often, the same people who have a substance use disorder are using it to treat a mental health issue that is underlying that substance use. So you can never split the two out.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
Two years have passed since the people of Iran took to the streets and brought about the Islamic Revolution of 1979 under the leadership of Ayatollah Imam Ruhollah Khomeini. Today, it is a proven fact that the 1979 Islamic Revolution created great hope among the deprived nations throughout the world. What were the main factors which led to the Islamic Revolution, you may ask? A society torn between tradition and Western modernity. Poverty and prosperity, dictatorship, and a yearning for democracy. The reasons are countless, but to answer the question in full, one should not look at the 1979 revolution as an isolated incident. Rather, it was the culmination of over a century's strive to end the dictatorial powers of monarchs, remove foreign influences from Iranian politics, distribute wealth while ensuring both economic prosperity and allow for central guidance and control, and to create a constitution that was both democratic and would not alienate the traditional and religious portion of the population. The world was surprised and astonished by the Iranian Revolution, which was led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini in exile from Paris. The personality of Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini was a critical element in redefining Iran's role in the region. Imam Khomeini's background, charisma, and thirst for revolting for the people of Iran influenced the atmosphere leading to the revolution. One can understand Khomeini's personality and beliefs by examining his background. His devotion to Islam, reflected by his simplistic, austere lifestyle focused on spiritual matters, attracted the majority of Iranian society, which was stricken with poverty. Many of these traditional citizens flocked to the modern cities seeking opportunity, only to wind up crowded into slums. Imam Khomeini's life of suffering and final return to Iran replicated a legacy of the oppressed experience. Imam Khomeini unwaveringly opposed monarchy, arguing that only rule by a leading Islamic jurist would ensure that the true Islamic ruling was properly followed. Imam Khomeini's novel artistry was seen in the way that he took the corrupted system that had been ruling the country and replaced it with a political system of service to the people rather than ignoring them. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. The story of the Iranian Revolution is not similar to the story of other revolutions in the 20th century, as the wave of Islamic revolution swept away the Shah's corrupt regime and brought a new political discourse which cannot be categorized either as a communist or a capitalist. It was and always will be an Islamic revolution. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mohammed. Now, just how major was the impact of the revolution that saw the ouster of Iran's king of that time, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, and the beginning of the era of Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhullah Khomeini as the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, first of all, you have to take a look at the whole region in general, and you will understand all these changes that took place throughout these 40 years. At that time, you had the major conflict, which is still here up till now, which is the Arab-Israeli conflict. At the time when Israel was the so-called invincible army, at the time when they used to launch, the Israeli occupation used to launch any aggression whenever they wanted at any Arab country, they reached up till Tunisia and other faraway countries like Sudan. Now we see that Israel, the occupation entity, right now is a besieged entity that is surrounded by rockets and missiles that are really spreading fear among the Zionist settlers. And all this is due to the policy which was adopted by the Islamic Revolution in Iran. I mean, the creation of a strategy of patience that took the long run into consideration, not rather very easily achieved the victories, but rather ones that took some time in order to be achieved. And I mean, this brought a shift and a major upside down, if you will, change in the strategic equation in the region. You saw the aggressor, now we see the aggressor, which used to take freedom in launching any aggression wherever they wanted, are now besieged even by the Gaza Strip. They cannot even launch an aggression on Gaza without taking thousands of calculations into consideration. So this is one of the major shifts that I see, Dean, that are very important and are the outcome of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic.
Well, four decades later after the revolution, in what aspect is this Islamic Revolution in Iran still mostly visible while the country still suffers from the fiercest economic and political sanctions that has ever hit a sovereign nation?
Well, also to take a logical course in this domain, look, in spite of all these economic sanctions and all this blockade against the Islamic Republic, you see that it is the major strategic power in the region, whereas other countries, such as Saudi Arabia, such as the United Arab Emirates and others, are not taken into consideration when it comes to the major players in the region and at the international level. You do not see, for instance, the United States minding the whatever the Saudis are saying, whereas you see every move and every act taken by the Islamic Republic of Iran is minded and is taken into analysis and so in the whole region. So this is one example. I know because of the shortage of time, we cannot discuss this in a very long way, but this serves as a good example that in spite of all these sanctions, in spite of all that sort of punishment that mm-hmm. was being targeted the Islamic Republic due to its political stances and due to its support to the oppressed throughout the region, mainly those related to the Arab-Israeli conflict, you see that Israel that the Islamic Republic is being punished for that. But still, one major lesson that can be learned to all the revolutions that are to come throughout history is that the Iranians have been supreme teachers in teaching the world how to turn a challenge into an opportunity. They have used these sanctions in order to develop their industries, to develop ways of
This is what I want to discuss further, because what you said is it falls on the on the shoulders of merchants, on traders, intellectuals, urban masses who played a grave role in the success of the Islamic Revolution led by Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini. These categories of citizens have suffered the most under this current wave of sanctions and the sanctions that have been there for the past 40 years, because the West believes that for a regime change to work in Iraq, in Iran, they have to target these specific categories and suffocate them as much as possible. How do you think this plan have worked so far?
Well, this is not new to the arrogant powers. Whenever they cannot achieve any triumph while dealing with the major opponents, I mean the government of Iran or the leadership in Iran, they turn to the weaker side. They try to target the as you said, the merchants, the ordinary people in the street. We have seen this also in Lebanon. Now, when they cannot achieve any victories against the Islamic resistance, they turn to suffocating at the economic level all the Lebanese people in order to turn into a phase when the whole Lebanese people, and hopefully, and I'm sure this, inshallah, will never happen, that the whole Lebanese people would turn to the accusation to the Islamic resistance that you are the reason why we are falling this. Now, the Iranians, and in a very clever step in this regard, have always focused on insight, on the well awareness of the whole factors and elements of the conflict. It has become clear that to all the people in Iran and Lebanon, all over the region, that if you give up to the demands of the oppressors, to the arrogant powers, the United States basically, you will have to pay a larger price than the one you are paying when you are steadfast and you are standing up against those challenges. So that's why this sort of answers this question, that those merchants, one way or another, know that if the Americans come to control the region, to control Iran, they are going to absorb and use all their resources of the country, and this the merchants will, and all the Iranian citizens will be paying the price to that. So the creation of this insight among the people of the Islamic Republic has been also fruitful and has been successful in this regard.
Well, we have less than 2 minutes. I want to ask you about the continued development and actually the impressive industrial progress in Iran despite the sanctions. But it is conveying a message to the world that Iran will never stop its development and its prosperity while simultaneously resisting the U.S. vicious plots in the region. But in that regard, a lot has been said about Iran's nuclear program. How do you think Iran will maneuver around this, that's supposedly a very large red flag by the West?
Yes, they have been doing this successfully for over 20 years now. They have been dealing with the threats. They have been dealing with the any good or signs of rapprochement, if you will, from the other from the Western world with similar steps. So there is no fear on this. But once again, I have to repeat this issue of the creation of the human being that is willing to stand up against any challenge in order to develop at the nuclear level, at the other levels of industrial and a few weeks ago, I think a new car was manufactured in Iran, a new model. So you see, the sanctions have not been able to achieve their goal of creating despair in the people of Iran.
Well, we still have to see how this supposed rapprochement, if it will happen, and how it will happen. I want to thank you very much, Mohammed Abed, political commentator, for joining us from Beirut to talk about the effect of the Islamic Revolution inside of Iran. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned. We will continue this matter about how the revolution affected the region after the break.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran revived high hopes in the region of West Asia, especially for the Palestinian people and the Lebanese people who suffered from the existence of Israel, specifically that Imam Khomeini's position from Israel was clear from the very beginning. The Islamic Revolution became the main force facing the Zionist project in the region and the main backer of the Palestinian liberation movements by helping create a regional power of allied resistance forces. From a revolution to a regional force in this following report.
Israel invaded Beirut in 1982 and drove the Palestinian resistance fighters out of Lebanon. There was fear of a coming horror and new alienation. Almost everything would have fallen apart had it not been for a few heroes who kept their fingers on the trigger in the face of what was defined as absolute evil. For so long, the Israeli entity thought that in its war on Lebanon, it would push its last opponents to surrender, which paves the way for scripting a new history for the region. However, its endeavor was faltered by a group of few men back then with a strength which came solely from faith that was later sponsored by a man who believed that the main confrontation with powers ruining the region could not take place until after the fall of the Shah of Iran, and as he said, happened. The Islamic Republic of Iran translated the words of its leader into action, sponsoring the first resistance force in Lebanon and later in Palestine with training, weapons, and funding until the victory of Lebanon was achieved and liberation was attained. Lebanon's victory was a good news for all oppressed countries, organizations, and individuals, as it increased steadfastness and determination in the path of what one aspires to in terms of glory and elevation, the realization of independence, freedom, and the establishment of justice. From Baghdad to Damascus, Beirut, Gaza, and Sana'a, passing through the oppressed nations of Bahrain and Hejaz, this yearn for social justice and liberation and the formation of an allied force of resistance across the region of West Asia would not have been possible without the support of those who believed in standing with the vulnerable in the face of the arrogant. It is what the essence of the revolution of Imam Ruhullah al-Khomeini was all about. The Islamic Revolution of 1979, which brought about the emergence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, became the awakening of the peoples of our region and beyond. The Islamic Republic of Iran's model of confrontation with imperialism has challenged the U.S. and its puppet Israeli regime in the region and across the entire world to such a degree that Iran's strategic influence in the form of an allied forces of resistance has become the U.S. and the Zionist regime's biggest concern.
To discuss this issue with us from London is Shabir Hassan Ali, political commentator. Thank you for being with us. Shabir, now, since its inception, the Islamic Republic of Iran has challenged the world's corrupt political system and created new political spaces that enabled the oppressed, for example, the oppressed Palestinians, to resist the American imperialism and the Zionist occupation. This has been a very long and bumpy ride in the region. How far will this be going with the current wave of regional normalization with the Israeli entity?
I think, first of all, the normalization will not make any difference. The normalization has always really been there. It's not something new. It's now just formalized. The resistance factions on the ground are alien to the occupiers that occupy them. For example, if you look at the countries of so-called UAE or so-called Saudi or so-called Bahrain, these countries are not ruled by their own people. They're ruled by imports, people who have no connection to the actual land and are purely working for the Zionists. The same way that Palestine is occupied by European Zionists. This is the same game. So in reality, the normalization, I don't think, will make any real difference. What it will do is it will make things a lot clearer in many ways. And it will hasten the demise of these entities like so-called Saudi Arabia, so-called Bahrain, so-called UAE, and all of these, as well as, of course, the parent of them, which is the Zionist entity occupying Palestine. And I think the important thing that we need to understand is what Iran is doing is not something particularly strange or particularly problematic. From a global perspective, it shouldn't be seen in this way. Because if you look at all of the global countries, people have alliances. This is something that's been there from like history, from ancient history.
Mm-hmm.
People from different countries, they make alliances, and they work together to try and better their lot. Now, if the countries that are making alliances are occupied by third parties who have no space there, then at the end of the day, a responsible country like Iran will make an alliance with the actual people on the ground, which is really what the country is. The country is not made up of these one or two families. It's made up of the actual people on the ground.
This is actually what scares the Western regime, because they extensively condemned the regional coordination that the Islamic Republic of Iran was able to achieve along with the allied forces of the resistance in all of West Asia, to a point that once surrounded Iran has now allies that have encircled the presence of the colonialists, the presence of the occupiers in the region. This led to a maximum campaign, pressure campaign of sanctions for everyone, including the allied forces of the resistance, not only for the Islamic Republic of Iran. How much do you think this will damage the performance of the regional allied forces of the resistance in West Asia?
I think if we look at the policy of sanctions, maximum pressure or otherwise, it's actually more damaging to the party making the sanctions. In the case of Iran and the resistance axis, the sanctions have been more damaging to America and to the West, because they have lost a very, very important market for which they can do trade. As for Iran and the resistance axis, yes, of course, there is a short-term pain, but ultimately it forces people to be reliant on themselves. And like Khamenei has said, and even said Hassan has said, we need to start relying on ourselves. We need to stop relying on the outside. And at the end of the day, the allies that the resistance axis has got, such as China, such as Russia, these are the powerhouses of trade in the world. Like China, everything is made in China. You know, from the most amazing things that America claims are its own, nothing is actually made in America. America is useless in terms of manufacture. Mm-hmm. Everything is made in China, and China is friends with the resistance axis. So even though these sanctions with the extraterritorial components and all of this talk of maximum pressure and all of this, really, this is only valid from a PR perspective. In reality, while there is pain for the people on the ground, I'll not say there isn't pain.
Mm-hmm.
What it will do is, when you push a person hard, ultimately what will happen is that person will say, well, okay, fine, there's no point me trying to negotiate with you because you're just not interested.
Mm-hmm.
I will go and make this myself, or I will deal with people who will deal with me.
Well, this is exactly what happened in the region, because we saw the emergence of Hezbollah in Lebanon to face the Israeli aggression. We saw the moral boost that was provided to the popular mobilization units in Iraq by the Islamic Republic, and the regional Cold War against both Saudi Arabia, to be honest with you, and also the Israeli regime. We had lending an Islamic flavor to the anti-imperialist sentiment in West Asia as a whole, and even openly challenging Western foreign policy by giving aid to Latin American countries, for example, like Venezuela. How can one explain this smooth flow of inspiration from the Islamic Revolution to cultures that are not even Islamic?
I think what we have to understand about the Islamic Revolution is, while it was Islamic, it was actually a global revolution of the oppressed against the oppressor. And Imam Khomeini mentioned this many times in many of his speeches, that anyone who sees themselves oppressed at the hand of the empire, at the hand of the powers of global arrogance or Zionism, they will all come together. Because, for example, if you take Venezuela has been hammered really badly. Cuba, even, has been hammered very badly by America just for wanting to be different, just for daring to be, to follow a different political ideology, and to not allow the infection of American capitalism and its various tentacles, if you like.
Simply for wanting to be sovereign nations.
Exactly. They want their sovereignty. And America doesn't want people to be sovereign. America wants people to be beholden to the empire. And when other countries see someone who is like a standard bearer, a flag bearer, for this movement of anti-imperialism, anti-arrogance, they all sort of come together, because good people generally come together. We may have differences in terms of our religious beliefs and all of this, but in terms of the ideology against imperialism mm-hmm. and against oppression, everyone is on the same page. And that also lets people discuss later on religious ideas and find commonalities in all of this. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have less than 2 minutes, but I want to discuss what the Biden administration might bring forward to the table in the region of West Asia, because they are sending sort of vague messages. They want to wrap Rushmore, but at the same time, they are increasing their military maneuvers in both Iraq and Syria. They're even, again, backing ISIS and Daesh and Al-Qaeda in Syria and in Iraq. They're targeting popular mobilization unit bases as well. It is obvious that also the current leader of the revolution, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, is suspicious of the American intentions. Do you think the region is moving towards negotiations or just a huge explosion?
I don't think there's going to be any negotiations. America has clearly said that they're not willing to reduce any of their sanctions or do anything from their side in order to encourage Iran to, you know, have any as a show of good faith. I think ultimately what they will do is just like what Obama did. They will manufacture and they will feed things like Daesh with a means to try and break the region further and cause more problems. But I think this time, the damage that will be done to the empire will be very serious.
Mm-hmm.
And it will end up leaving and taking its lapdogs like the Saudis and the Israelis out of the region. It won't be easy, but I think that, as they say, you can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Shabir Hassan Ali, political commentator, for joining us from London to talk about how the Islamic Revolution led by Imam Ruhollah Khomeini affected the entire world, not only West Asia. Thank you for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.